Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Monday was our municipal election. And normally I would say, well, I assume you know that. But based on some of the voting turnout numbers, I almost feel like I have to explain that because Hamilton, I mean, we hit a turnout of 35 and a couple percentage points, roughly percent. That's how many percent showed up. And this was for an election that we had heard for months was to oust a highly unpopular council. I mean, people were fired up. We were told this was going to be the pitchforks and torches to City Hall kind of election to get rid of the bums, and 35%. And what was amazing is that we actually weren't the worst. Toronto was 29%, according to reports I've seen. Kitchener, 20% voter turnout. 20%. The whole province, the last number I saw was 36%. So we were just here in Hamilton, just under the number. It is not good. I want to bring in John Beebe. He's the director of the Democratic Engagement Exchange at Toronto Metropolitan University. John, thank you for the time today.
I'm glad to be here.
I have seen these numbers, and I got to tell you, I don't necessarily expect that we're going to be seeing 80 or 90%, but when I'm looking at 35, 29, 20%, that's stunning, isn't it?
No, it is. These are not typical. I mean, yes, during municipal elections, we tend to see lower participation, but these are, like, as you say, stunning. And we should be worried because even in Hamilton, you're exactly right. In a highly competitive election, lots of people talking about it, or at least we thought they were. But number of people who actually show up, not so good. And so that is something that we should be worried about. We should help to understand what's going on because we need our democracy. We need elections. That's the lifeblood of a democracy. And if people aren't participating, we got a problem.
Where is the gap coming from? Because I do believe, like, you know, being here on the radio, but also being out in public, there was tons of talk about this election. So I don't believe that people didn't know that it was on. And I don't believe that people didn't have opinions about what was happening. So why is it proving so difficult to get people from that point to make the half hour stop or whatever it is into a voting place to cast their ballot?
Yeah, I mean, and when I voted last week, you know, or I guess earlier this week on Monday, it seems a bit a long week, but I think it took me 2 minutes to vote. Voting is easy. So that's not the problem. You know, the problem isn't that we put up barriers to participation. For most people, it's super easy to go and vote. I think there can be a challenge with people knowing who to vote for, but, you know, in Hamilton, I'm not sure that was the issue. You know, I think we have to do a hard look at what's going on. Is it the toxic political environment that many people are feeling? Is it a sense of isolation that brought on by COVID? I mean, we know that when people feel lonely or disconnected from their communities, they're much less likely to participate. You know, all of the above. You know, I think we got a lot of work to do to figure out what's going on here.
I know that some people listening right now will surely be screaming at the radio, well, online voting would solve all of our problems because then I wouldn't have to go in even the 2 minutes.
Right.
I mean, some people wouldn't be too. And yet, yeah. John, I looked up today a number of the cities that introduced online voting this year thinking, well, that, you know, I'm guessing they must be up in the 60, 70% because it's so easy. It's just, it's like going on Amazon and hitting buy on a purchase. And we all do that. Brantford brought it in. I think they were at 27%. Thunder Bay brought it in. They were at 40 something. Kingston was at something like 32 or 33. This clearly is not the panacea that solves all the problems.
No. And unlike going to Amazon where, yes, it's just a one click, super easy to vote. Remember the first time you did online banking and got that all set up and they send you PIN numbers, you got to enter your PIN number and you got to remember it and you got to get it in the mail. That's exactly what online voting is. It's actually not easier. Often going in person is much easier than online voting, especially if you're not happen to be on the voter roll. So if you've moved recently, you know, you're a renter, you're not a homeowner, so you're not automatically on the voter roll. It can be a real hassle to do online voting. So, no, there's not a panacea on online voting. And I also worry, you know, when we have super close elections and, you know, in this age of misinformation, somebody starts to question the election results. You know, the old-fashioned way, when we got a piece of paper, we can count them up, we can look at them. You know, I'm kind of a fan of that.
Yeah, you know what? I've long thought the same thing. Although, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, well, what do we do? Well, I mean, what is the answer? And something else that I know people may be saying, because I've read it and I've heard people say it as well, we have to have mandatory voting. And to me, mandatory voting would be the absolute worst scenario, because I don't think we want, if you're not willing to engage enough to go and cast a vote, you probably don't care. I don't really want you then deciding who's going to govern us if you really don't care.
Again, all these shortcuts, I don't think are the fundamental answer. I think we got to do some hard work in our communities. We have to find better ways to connect people. We have to do work in between elections so that people feel connected to their local governments. You know, I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, listening to our communities. Well, let's get out there and genuinely find some innovative ways to do that so that people feel engaged and people feel like they have a voice, not just feel like, but actually have a voice in changing policies that impact them every day. And there are great innovations. There are people dedicated to that effort. But, you know, we got to double down on that because we got a problem.
We haven't, I don't think, too many places, certainly in Hamilton, it hasn't been made available yet. We haven't seen breakdowns of voting, age demographic or urban, rural, or those kind of things. But if you had to guess based on what we've seen over the last number of years, is age an issue here? Is it, I mean, is youth or older people, is one more likely to disengage in the municipal electing?
Yeah, I mean, the hard data on that, you're right, is very limited because, of course, we keep our vote private, and so we don't, you know who voted. But we do know from other data around voting that young people vote at a much lower rate often than older people. But we also know that that's not immutable. I mean, in 2015, during the federal election, you know, youth participated at a much higher rate. We saw an 18% increase in youth participation because we had political parties reaching out to them, encouraging them to participate. So if we have people reaching out and engaging young people, engaging these other communities that aren't often voting, people will vote. But we have to give them a reason to, because right now they're not, you know, feeling like anybody cares about them, and we build up this really negative cycle. We have to be willing to sort of invest in that work and do it in between elections.
Do you, oh boy, I'm scared to ask this question because I think I know what the answer might be, but do you see this turning around anytime in the next little while?
Well, I do think the positive thing that I'm seeing is we're having this conversation here. There's a lot of people having a conversation said, you know, whoa, we got a problem here. This is not okay. So let's take a look at it. And we haven't had that conversation before here, you know, especially in Canada. You know, we all see what's happening in the U.S., what a disaster that is. We don't want that. You know, ironically, they have high voter turnout. We don't want to go that way. They have high voter turnout because they have a politics of division, right? They have politics of fear. People turn out because they're fearful, they're divided. We don't want to go that route. But we do want to figure out a way to engage our communities and connect people to democracy, because I do think there is a widespread support for democracy. But not necessarily the way people feel democracy is practiced now, but certainly the concept that they have a control of their lives. So that's what we have to double down on and engage our communities more effectively.
Just before we go, in a place like Kitchener, where they had 20%. Now, that was really unusual, but nonetheless, in a place like that, or even somewhere that's got 25%, they obviously have a mandate, whoever gets elected, they have won fair and square, but can democracy, can governance work properly when that few people are engaged in the process?
Yeah, I mean, I think any of our communities, you know, where we have just a third of the people voting or less, you know, it's incumbent upon anybody who wins in that situation to reach out, and engage with the community and listen more to what people have to say. People who may not have voted, people who didn't necessarily support them, but no one can go forward with a clear mandate. They just haven't had the level of support they need to say that they have a mandate around a specific agenda. So that would be a starting point. And then, you know, all like, you know, our United Ways, our community organizations, they have to step up and engage and find ways to connect people to our local governments in ways that make them feel like there's something there for them.
It is a fascinating topic. And when I say fascinating, largely very troubling, but nonetheless interesting to see how there might be a solution for this. John Beebe, Director of the Democratic Engagement Exchange at Toronto Metropolitan University. Really appreciate the time today. Thank you for this.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Scott Radley Show here on 900 CHML. Earlier today was up at Michelangelo's for the 2022 induction ceremony for the class of the Hamilton Sports Hall of Fame. It's always a good thing. It's a good thing, honestly. I really believe this. It's a good thing that we have this in the city. We need things like this to honor people that have done amazing stuff. And I was saying up there earlier today that for a long time, I mean, the Hall of Fame has been around now for 13 years, but for a long time, we seem to be the only city that didn't have something like this. So kudos to the people who are behind it for getting that going and building something up that now has traction and now is something that people look forward to being involved with. The guy who is the person I'm talking about, at least one of them, one of the main ones, who is the chairman of that Hamilton Sports Hall of Fame. His name is Gary McKay. He joins me now. Gary, how are you today?
How are you?
Excellent. It was congratulations on another class. I mean, probably the name I would think that most people are going to be familiar with, just the average fan, would be Jim Young, Dirty 30 from the BC Lions. Which amazing story. The only man ever to be traded from the NFL to the CFL.
Yes, and it was great to see him there. Jim, of course, played in the CFL for Vancouver for many years, and that made that his home after his career. He still lives out there, but he's in a number of football halls of fame already. But when we called to tell him, he was very excited and said he would make it home, and flew home with some relatives and was there today, and it was great to see him.
Also inducted today, Dr. Gene Sutton, who many, many, many people know. Nick Genovese, who was a blind golfer, amazing story with him. Johnny Miles, of course, the runner that everybody is aware of. And Dragon Boat racer and coach and everything, Kathy Levy, who I think brought her entire Dragon Boat crew with her today to the function. Oh, there were a lot of them there.
No kidding. There were a lot of them there. And they were having a good time. They were hooting and hollering and really enjoyed themselves. And she really deserves to be in our Hamilton Sports Hall of Fame, not only as an athlete, because she piloted a number of these boats to world championships and still does, and as a coach, but for starting the whole Not Abreast Dragon Boat team for cancer survivors and has done so much good work, and from that has started them in other cities, has helped Sarasota, Florida get their program off the ground. So it was great to see her, and she really deserves to be in our Sports Hall of Fame.
Absolutely. And the first husband and wife team with David Levy, Dr. David Levy, who was in before. Now, just before we move on here, because you had an announcement today that I really want to talk about, but this was actually an introduction for three classes because COVID had kind of messed things up. So it was the class of 2020, 2021, and 2022. But at the very end, you told a story, and I don't know if you don't have your notes probably in front of you and you weren't expecting me to ask this, but can you share the story? There was an amazing connection between some of the people who were being inducted today.
Sure. Patsy Brandino's daughter, who couldn't
Patsy
be there
Brandino,
today,
by the way, who was a boxer who was
boxer,
being inducted.
Right. He went in as part of the, which class was it here? One of the last two classes. And she couldn't be here for the ceremony, but we talked on the phone. And she talked about the fact that Hamilton, we all know it as a big city, but it's a very close-knit, somewhat small community in sports. It's all interwoven. And she told the story of how, her father was going in to the Hall of Fame today, being formally inducted. She mentioned that when she lived in Hamilton, her husband had won the Canusa Games Ivan Miller Award. Ivan Miller, of course, a former sports editor of The Spectator, who was also inducted today. And she mentioned that she was training to be a teacher, and her mentor was Dr. Gene Sutton, who also went in today. And then to top it off, she said when her parents got married years before, the entertainment at their wedding, and this is Patsy Brandino's wedding, was a blind singer who was also a champion golfer named Nick Genovese, who was also inducted today. Just an amazing coincidence, you know, that it's all tied together, the sports community in Hamilton.
You didn't plan all that. You didn't call her and say, who should we put in with your father?
No, not at all. And I'll tell you an amazing story. I invite all of your listeners to go to the HamiltonSportsHallOfFame.com and look at our videos done by Mo Masoudi. And the video on Nick Genovese starts off with him singing O Sole Mio, and it is spectacular. He was a good singer.
Yeah, he was a singer. In fact, when that video started, I was like, oh, that's nice. And then I saw on the screen, it's like him. I was like, oh, that's pretty good. That sounds a lot better than I recall Gary McKay ever singing in the Spectator newsroom.
Well, I would dispute that, but...
All right, so Gary, a longtime sports writer with the Spectator. So at the end of the event, you did have an announcement, and this, I think, is a really important thing for this, because for 13 years, the Hamilton Sports Hall of Fame has been inducting people, but it has been an online presence. So you said what at the end?
Well, basically, we have been collecting items that have been donated to us over the years, and we have a nice collection, but we'd had nowhere to display it. We started out, we moved into the Eva Rothwell Center, which is the old Robert Land School on Wentworth North, and we have a room in there in a storage area. But because of COVID the last 3 years, we haven't really been able to get in there much to do much in terms of preparing it. But we've done some, and we've committed to sometime in this January to finally being able to let people come in and look at our collection. Now, we're not going to be open every day. We don't know what days or what hours, but sometime in January, we will open the doors.
And some of the stuff, and I know that you're always looking for new things, and anyone who's listening who has some wonderful piece of Hamilton sports memorabilia that they want to donate or probably loan, I'm sure you could reach Gary through the HamiltonSportsHallOfFame.com website and do that. But there are already a number of things that I would say, Gary, rise above the other things, like really cool things that you've been able to pick up.
Oh, absolutely. And even this year, when we inducted Johnny Miles, a famous runner, we struggled finding a relative, but out of the blue, his nephew called and said, I'm Bill Miles. I'm Johnny Miles' nephew. And he had a good connection. He'd lived in Hamilton. And he said, by the way, you probably know that my uncle, Johnny Miles, ran in the 1930 British Empire Games then, now the Commonwealth Games, in Hamilton. And he said, I have the jacket that he wore for the march in of the athletes, and I would like to give you that. And we, up till then, we thought there was only one of those left in existence, and it was in the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame. And now we have one, and it's actually in better shape than theirs.
Well, that's good. Hold out for them. See if you can swap it for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you know, fund
I've got it listed on eBay right now. No, just kidding.
There, it is the start. The hall has been going, as I say, for a while. The start of building all the collection, everything else. I think it's a great thing. I think it's a wonderful thing you're doing, and it's great that we finally have some place, or will soon have some place, that people can go and see some of this stuff and be reminded of some of the history of sports in this city. And if they do want to, is that, as I described, through that website? Is that the best place? If someone
you can go onto our website and contact us, and if you have something that you think is historically significant connection with Hamilton sports, we'd love to talk to you about it.
HamiltonSportsHallOfFame.com.
Go look it up. Thank you, Scott, by the way, for being the master of ceremonies today.
It's always fun. It is always fun. Gary McKay, thank you for doing this today, and really appreciate it. We will be watching, and go look at those videos, by the way. They are cool by Mo. I got to take a very quick break here. Back right after this. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
It is 6:50 on a Wednesday evening. It is time for not Ben's story of the day, not Tom's story of the day, Matt's story of the day. Matt is in today. Matt will be the judge, jury, and executioner of great wisdom at the end of this segment. Matt is back at the office. I'm going to give Matt three unique stories from parts all over the world. Matt will then contemplate them, consider them, think about them, give great, great weight to all of them, and decide which one is Matt's story of the day. Matt, are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Well, that is good, because these are today, these are hefty. These are hefty, hefty stories with deep implications for I don't know what. Let us start in Kentucky, where let me ask you this, Matt. Have you ever at some place along the way in your life, in high school or whatever else, have you ever acted in a play or acted in any other venue?
Yes, I was in Clowns.
Oh yeah, and were you a clown?
I was.
Okay, so you've dipped your toe into the pool of the acting world.
I have, yes.
Okay, and many people listening have too, whether in high school or wherever else, community theater. Well, there's a guy in Kentucky who apparently has really, 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 really wanted to have a role on CSI for a long time. The TV show about Vegas and the people who solve the crimes and everything else. He has really wanted this. So he has posed 321 different times for extended periods on TikTok as a cadaver in different locations. He has done TikToks of himself lying seemingly dead in different locations. It is acting at its base level, I suppose, where there's no acting. You just lie as still as humanly possible. Anyway, it seems to have worked, because CSI has finally reached out to him, and he is going to be an extra playing the role of, yes, a cadaver, a cut-up, autopsied cadaver in an upcoming episode of CSI.
Which one?
It says in CSI Vegas.
Okay.
So I guess the original now, but he is a corpulent man of probably, I would guess, 50 to 55 years old. And it would seem that he has an incredible talent for feigning death, which I guess everyone's got their gift. Everyone's got the thing that they, you know, can have as a claim to fame, being a cadaver, being a corpse. If that's his thing, I guess, you know, congratulations. He has risen to the top of his profession.
Yeah, you know, he could have got an agent, but, you know, it's more fun to do like hundreds of TikToks, you know?
Yeah, he says, I got an email from CBS that said they'd seen me on TikTok and wanted to offer me the part. At first, I couldn't believe it, but they flew me out to California. And the picture of him from the shot from the show is, and this is rather ghoulish and macabre, but his rather, what's the nice word, corpulent body being unzipped from a body bag. Let's go with that.
Okay.
You can keep an eye. He kind of looks like the original doctor. Remember the doctor on the original CSI who had the two canes? He kind of looks like him. But anyway, look for that guy if you're a regular on the show. All right. Story number two. This one, we've been talking yesterday, today, Monday about the election. This is a municipal politics story, not here in San Francisco. City Council in San Francisco set out to build a public washroom in a part of town. A single public washroom. That's all. That was the plan. We're going to build a single public washroom. Well, as happens, I guess, things have spiraled out of control, and the construction of said single public washroom now will not be finished until 2025 and will come in at a price tag of $1.7 million. Because why wouldn't it? It's just one thing after another, apparently. Certain assemblymen, that's what they call their counselors, certain assemblymen are freaking out about this. And apparently every single thing has delayed this and extended it and prolonged it and protracted it. Now $1.7 million. So, You know, no matter what you think of Hamilton City Council, at least we've never built a single bathroom that takes 2 years to build at that cost. Story number three, let us go to, this is, I will warn you, this story falls into the category of somewhat disgusting, although not in the usual way you might expect. In Iran, there was a guy who was 94 years old, Matt, and for whatever reason, it's a little unclear of what the reason was. There was clearly he had some sort of phobia or something. He had not bathed in over 50 years. There was a story behind this that he was fearful of bathing. I don't quite know what might have happened in his past that would have inspired this, but he was known as the world's dirtiest man. 50. What is the longest that you can think that you have ever gone without a bath or a shower?
Well, like
a few days, maybe.
Yeah, because
probably.
I had a cast at one point, and you know, we had to like put like a garbage bag on and everything. You know.
All right, so a few days, maybe a week under extenuating circumstances. I'm thinking that probably. I mean, I spent a summer in the middle of the jungle in Papua New Guinea. We had no showers or bath, but we had a river. And so I would bathe in there. It was unfortunate there were crocodiles in the river. You bathed really quickly. But even then, we didn't go for a long time. It was every day or every second day. 50 years this guy did not bathe.
So
was totally freaked out that he would not bathe.
I'd like to know if he did anything, though. Like, did he do something like bathing adjacent or what? Like, did he like take like an axe shower or what are we talking?
No, it appears nothing.
Nothing.
And his other phobia was he would not eat any fresh food. Only, I don't know what food I'm not sure. Anyway, that's only half the story. The fact that this guy had not bathed for 50 years, you would say, oh, well, that's the story. No. That's just the intro to the story. Because recently, he was convinced by some friends to have a bath for the first time in 50 years. Weeks later, he fell ill and died.
Yeah.
So he was right all along. Bathing was going to kill him. So will your story of the day today be the guy, the actor who portrays cadavers and has now got his big break in CSI? Will it be the San Francisco town or city council that is spending $1.7 million over 2 years to build a single washroom? Or will it be the world's dirtiest man who after 50 years was convinced to bathe and promptly died?
I'm going to keep it brief here. It's got to be the dirty old man. That's
well,
all I got.
See, now we didn't call him a dirty old man.
I mean, he's the other kind of dirty old man. You know what I'm saying.
It kind of is. Kind of is. I hadn't even thought of it that way. It's amazing. If you just put the words in a different order,
yes.
The world's dirtiest man, but the dirtiest old man, you have two completely different images. But yes, you are correct. All right, there is Matt's story of the day.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Hour number two of the Scott Radley Show here on 900 CHML. So glad you are with us. We're going to be chatting about the live music industry, an industry that I would have thought would have been booming right now because we're just seemingly out of COVID. We all act like we're out of COVID. We're pretending or believing we're out of COVID. But it seems to be an industry that's having its problems. We're going to chat with Alan Cross about that in just a moment. First, your quiz question this evening. Here we go. The name of what popular beach drink translates literally as strained pineapple? The name of what popular beach drink translates literally into English as strained pineapple? 905-645-3221 or *9900. Those are the numbers. Matt will take your call. 905-645-3221 or *9900. You can also text your answer to 905-645-3221. Put your answer and put your first name so we know who we're talking to. The name of what popular beach drink? Doesn't have to be at a beach. It's just one of the places you would normally drink it. Translates literally as strained pineapple. Waiting to hear Your answers on that one. Can't wait to see who can come up with that one. It's a tricky one today. No question, it's a bit of a tricky one. Speaking of a tricky one, as we try to find a segue, always hard. I would have thought, as I said, that the music industry right around now would have been just a fantastic place to be. I mean, yeah, I know the summer is over, so, you know, the summer may have been the greatest, but nonetheless, we're going into the winter. It's still, you can still do your thing, and not every part of the world is cold. So I would have thought that after COVID, after all this time away, that everybody would just be dying to get out to some shows, that the artists would be just dying to get on the road. And I think that's probably true. And yet my next guest has written a piece for Global News. The live music industry is in big trouble. Here's why. Alan Cross is one of the great music writers you will find anywhere. A great music historian. A man who knows his way around every single thing, it seems, in the world of music. He joins us now. Alan, how are you tonight?
Good. How are you doing?
I am apparently better than those in the music industry. When I read this, I thought, boy, you've laid out a case for why it's in trouble, but it's not at all what I expected.
Yeah, there's a lot going on right now. Let's start with inflation. This is a big problem. We have so many acts on the road. They're making up for dates that were canceled or postponed during COVID. Plus, there's the usual business of the day that needs to be done. So there's a shortage of gear. There's a shortage of trucks. There's a shortage of roadies. Again, with roadies, what happened during COVID is a lot of them left the industry, and any who managed to survive and who are left are asking for more money. Gas is more expensive. Airlines are more expensive. Hotel rooms are more expensive. Everything has gone up. I have heard from several bands who have gone out on the road to play dates that they were supposed to play in 2020 and 2021, but they went out and played those dates with the budgets and fees set for back then, but playing today. And they have come home after playing a string of solo shows, thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars in debt. So that's a big problem. Another issue,
and with that, so I'm assuming when we're talking about those people, we're not talking about the huge, huge stars, because with them, with the ticket prices and volume and everything else, you would think that they would be able to cover that. We're talking about the middle range acts, correct?
There's a very thin layer of superstar acts, and they're largely immune to a lot of these things, but anybody below that is really suffering. But even the big acts, Justin Bieber, Shawn Mendes, and any variety of others who have stated publicly that they're canceling tours, they're postponing tours because they're completely burned out. With nobody making any money from streaming, except for the big stars, there's this huge pressure for these acts to play more and more and more shows. And they are, because that's an important revenue stream. But at the same time, they're playing for this, maybe the same fees that they agreed to 2 years ago. Plus, they're paying the costs of today. So the pressure to keep going and going and going is very intense. And if someone, and here's another issue, if someone in your crew ends up with COVID and you have to cancel a show or two or three, that's enough to put the entire tour into the red. So you've got two pressures, the cost pressures and the pressures to keep going. And I guess a third pressure is what happens if somebody gets sick.
What the idea we've heard about, you know, Justin Bieber was having, I know that we talked about, as you say, going off the road because of stress, and Shawn Mendes and that. And I know that probably an awful lot of people hear that and go, oh yeah, okay. Like, suck it up. You know, you're making millions of dollars and your entire job is to go out on stage and to be adored. I mean, how rough can your life really be? Do you believe that we're giving a fair shake to that, or are we making too light of their situation?
I'll tell you what, you go on the road for 6 months living out of a suitcase and you tell me how that feels with absolutely no sense of roots. No, I mean, it's, touring is exhausting. It's hard. You want to also say it's bad for the environment. It's, you know, it doesn't matter how much you're getting paid after a while. If you've got no more gas in the tank, you can't serve anyone. And there's so much pressure on a, you know, on a singular solo performer like a Mendes or a Justin Bieber, that, you know, after a while, you just got to say, I can't do it anymore. And there's nothing wrong with that.
You, when you talk about inflation, so the inflation clearly is costing the bands more. And if they're not locked in already, that's going to be way more expensive. But they are a business too. They have management. They have business. They're not willingly going to accept losses. So it seems inevitable that if their costs are going up, the price of tickets is also going to go up.
Well, there are certain prices that are being passed along to the fan. Yes, that's very true. But a bigger problem is the fact that there's so many shows and only so much money to go around. Again, we're trying to catch up on 2.5 years of cancellations. Plus, we're getting down to, you know, all the tours that have to happen today. So we had a glut of shows over the summer. It was incredible. Sometimes there would be 2 or 3 major shows in the GTA area on the same night. And, you know, there's only so many people and only so much money to go around. And you have some of these artists who are now, who have been looking out over empty seats or over empty space in a venue going, where is everybody? Well, the answer is, there are too many shows and the price for each of these shows is higher than it's been in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years. So that's causing a problem. You know, we just can't service all the shows that are out there.
Do you think, because that has been a complaint, and I know you've written about this and I know we've talked about it, the complaint that going to concerts has become so stinking expensive, not all of them, but a lot of them. I mean, ticket prices are just, you know, so much higher than they used to be. Do you believe that is then largely driven by cost, or are we also talking in some cases, especially again, those superstar elite level where it's like, let's set a price and who cares? Well, people will buy it.
Well, again, this is a much longer conversation, but basically artists have been underpricing their concert tickets for years. And what has happened is that secondary ticket sellers have been coming along, scooping up those tickets at face value and then selling them for a double or triple or even quadruple the price of the original. So that has been a problem. The lack of revenue coming in from anywhere else other than playing live has also been a problem. If you're not selling any CDs and if you're not making a lot of money from streaming, that revenue is going to come from somewhere. So you raise the price of the ticket. We've had problems with something like the Astroworld Festival last year where so many people died and were injured. The insurance actuarial tables are going to look at things and go, no, everybody has to pay for these things. I mean, there were 3,000 outstanding lawsuits from that one festival alone. And, you know, the insurance companies, the people who insure, you know, tours are looking at going, you know what, you're going to have to suck it up and pay more for your premiums. That gets passed along to the audience. So there's, again, a tremendous number of financial pressures coming down on artists from all angles, and many of them are having a very hard time coping. I'll give you one more. Brexit, for example. It used to be that if you were a British act, you could come and go to the continent as many times as you wanted without having to pay for visas or worry about customs or any other additional fees going over and onto the continent. That's gone now. There was a band called Yard Act who was getting ready to leave for a tour of Europe, and they were at Stansted Airport, and then the singer said, I just can't do this anymore. And the rest of the band and the crew agreed, and they just went home. So there have been, within Britain itself, there's another problem with their high energy prices. Venues can't afford to keep the lights on. And there are some fears that live music will suffer over the course of the winter, just as they did during COVID, simply because the venue owners can't afford to pay for the electricity.
And you've touched on something else here, and we keep saying that, but there was a time when I guess if you were a decent act, superstar or even that middle range, when you could have probably survived even without a concert tour because you could have lived off your CDs if you were selling them or your vinyl or whatever else. There were other sources of income. now with streaming, it seems, you know, I mean, the amount that they get for streaming is not a lot of money. Now, if you want to live a certain lifestyle, you almost have to be on the road.
You do. You really do. And by and large, the smaller the act they are, you are, the more you have to play, because that's the only way you're seeing any kind of revenue. I've heard of another situation where vinyl sales among some of these smaller acts are down simply because they can't get their orders fulfilled. If you're Taylor Swift and you've got an album coming out, no problem. How many pieces of vinyl do you need? But if you're a mid-level band or a lower-end band and you're ordering vinyl in lots of 100 or 500 or 1,000, good luck. You're waiting 6, 8, 9, 10 months for your order to come in. So you're not deriving any revenue from that. And the margins on vinyl can be very, very nice. I mean, even buying 2 or 3 records at a gig is financially significant to many acts. Now that has been taken away. So they may be getting, you know, what they deserve playing live from, you know, ticket sales and whatever, but they're relying more on merchandise than ever before. You know, if here's a plea, I mentioned this to somebody today. If you're going out to a show anytime soon, and the smaller the band, the better, please buy some merch, because that's probably the most meaningful thing that you'll be able to do for them that night.
There is another question as you were talking that also came to mind. How many great bands became great without playing all that much? Like, it seems that that is your fastest way to become. I mean, it's a cycle, but, you know, we want to go see the great bands, but you only become a great band if you're on the road playing all the time. And if you can't afford to get on the road, how good can you really get if you're just practicing in the garage or just playing in the studio? You need that live experience to become great, don't you?
Back in the day, you could be a studio band, because if you had a hit record, that was all your revenue stream. But today, you can't really be such an act unless you're, let's say, a beat maker for a guy like Drake. And you could work out of your bedroom all you want, let Drake take all the glory, yeah, and you get your share of the money. But, you know, today, playing live, it's almost, you know, unthinkable that you could survive without being able to do that, unless you get some sort of fat licensing deal or you get some placement in a movie or a TV show or something like that. And that'll only take you for a few months anyway. So yeah, you need to be on the road. And the other thing too, is that there is nothing like having a bunch of strangers tell you the truth about your music in real time, night after night after night. That makes you a better musician. That makes you a better player. That makes you a better songwriter. That makes you a better entertainer.
Well, I just find it so difficult to think that, and I'll just pick, you know, one or two. But I mean, if the Rolling Stones had not spent their early years on the road touring, I find it hard to believe that they would have become what they were. Maybe they would have, but it seems that that experience, the Beatles in the Cavern Club, I mean, that those are things that they always seem to point to and say that made us into a great band.
Yeah, back in the day, that's the way you did it. The Beatles would play 6 sets a night at the Star Club in Hamburg on the Reeperbahn. And that made them into what they are. You know, they were tight. They had great harmonies. And, you know, it's practice, 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 practice. However, there are lots of acts today who have, you know, have had hit singles but have never played a live show thanks to the technology they've got in their bedroom. How long their careers will last is,
well, that's
still,
yeah,
something to be determined.
It is. It's a fascinating piece. It's you can find it at Global News. The live music industry is in big trouble. Here's why. And if you don't want to go there, go to a Journal of Musical Things, which is Alan's website, which if you like music or just pop culture or just entertainment stuff, it is a tremendous repository of ways to waste time by reading everything on there. It's an amazing place to spend some time. Alan, really appreciate the time, as always. Thanks for doing this.
You bet. No problem.
That is Alan Cross, one of the great, excuse me, one of the great music commentators and writers. It is an amazing thing, though, to think that the music industry, which, I mean, have we not just always assumed you can always go to a show? And not only that, but we have, for as long as I've been alive, waited excitedly for big acts to come. I don't go to all the shows, obviously, but we, you know, some huge act is coming. Oh man, we got to go see them. Now you've got 3, 4, as Alan says, coming at the same time. Who can afford that? So you end up squeezing this industry because there's only so much money. There's only so much pie to be sliced up to go around. It's a remarkable thing. I am, I'm not glad I'm not a musician, but you know, if you're one of those mid-range acts, you might be relieved you're not a musician right now, because how do you find your spot in that world? It's tough. Let's take a break. Back after this on the Scott Radley Show. Stay with us.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Scott Radley Show. Going to give you the quiz question in just a second, but I had to raise this because, well, let me just explain. So just before we went to our last break, someone sent me, a friend sent me a link to a story that they thought was worth talking about on the air. And I appreciate that people would send me something that, you know, would be a good talking point. However, you ever heard that phrase that says, if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is? All right, so the story is about a DNA tests prove a milkman fathered over 800 children in California. The story goes that back in the 50s and 60s, this milkman was working his route, and it wasn't just the route he was working, and thought he was sterile, but left behind hundreds of children from his visits with the lonely housewives. Great story. Except, you know, it took all of exactly 90 seconds to check this and find out that it's not true. That it was from a satirical website that has at the bottom of its website, it's a fabricated satirical newspaper and comedy website. It says it's satirical. And yet, have you not received, and I'm talking to everyone listening, have you not at some point received something or seen something that one of your Facebook friends or someone else has given you, that they pass something along to you and they go, oh, look at this story. You got to see this. It's anti one side or anti another, or shows that some leader is whatever. It is not difficult in the time of the interwebs to do the barest modicum of a search when some story comes that looks like it's, I'm not really sure about this, and find out whether it's true or not. It took 90 seconds. And this is why we now have people, sorry if I'm sounding upset, I'm not, it's more laughing, but this part is for real. This is why we have now government saying, well, we need to control the internet. We need to censor the internet because, you know, people they're sending fake news. It wouldn't be fake news if people just used 4 active brain cells and looked to see that the story that they were looking at was not real. Anyway, I don't know that it's the responsibility of a government, of any government, to have to do our common sense looking things up for us. This was a fun story that someone sent, and I appreciate that they sent it. They didn't realize, but my goodness, it does not take much time to see if what you're looking at is true. So next time you see that some politician did something and it sounds outrageous, like completely bizarre, well, maybe look before you resend that to someone else and say, is this really true? Or some drug has killed 52,000 people, but we don't want to talk about it. Well, look it up, you know, spend a little bit of time and just say, we shouldn't need to have someone else doing our checking for us. That's how you end up putting too much power in the hands of governments, by not doing the work ourselves that we could do. Let's move along. Totally unrelated and much lighter fare. The name of what popular beach drink translates literally into English as strained pineapple? 905-645-3221 or *9900. You can also text me the answer. 905-645-3221. Text me the answer along with your name if you think you know what that one is. What popular beach drink. And once again, it's not only consumed on a beach, but that's often where you would get it. Translates literally into English as strained pineapple. Back after this.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
How many of you, hands up, honest, moment of great honesty here. How many of you ever bought something from infomercials? Anyway, okay, come on. Honesty here. How many were sitting up watching TV late one night back before they had actual programming that filled most of the evening, although some places still do the infomercials? How many of you were ever watching TV late one night and some product came on and you found yourself weirdly intrigued and then went to get the wallet and slapped the credit card down, or at least called it in over the phone, and ended up ordering some regrettable infomercial item? I think there's probably a lot of hands up if we were telling the truth right now. It's okay. Many people, you can still go to stores where they sell only things that are sold or advertised on TV. And some of the stuff is really cool. There's no question. Some of the stuff is really cool. But some of the stuff you look and you go, there were people who bought this? Well, let's talk about that, shall we? I found this list of some of the most bizarre things that not just were advertised on infomercials, but that did very well on infomercials. These are things that, you know, this is not something that, I mean, I can't even off the top of my head come up with like some crazy idea. This is not the crazy, crazy thing. These are the ones that they moved a lot of product. There were a lot of people that apparently thought these were worth buying. I'll give you an example. And I got to say this one carefully. Not the teddy bear, the titty bear, T-I-D-D-Y, the titty bear, which apparently, and I had not seen this one before. This one was new to me. But these apparently sold many, 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 many of them. They were a small teddy bear-like object that you attach to your seatbelt that was supposed to make wearing your seatbelt more comfortable. I don't understand how wearing a teddy bear would make a seatbelt more comfortable. I don't know how putting anything under your seatbelt so it was in a lump would not end up being just as uncomfortable or more uncomfortable than just your regular old seatbelt, but did very, very well, they say. This one, I am convinced that if in fact it's true, and if in fact it sold a lot of these, it can only mean there were a lot of really drunk guys watching TV late at night with their wallet nearby. There is no other explanation for the success of the potty putter. The potty putter. If you ever saw this, it was literally a probably 2 foot diameter putting green with a cutout for the base of the toilet. You would put this putting green on the floor in front of the toilet. It has a little hole, a golf hole with a flag, and you sit on the toilet and you putt. Like whatever distance, a foot. I guess you don't want to hit it too hard because you can't get up to walk and go get the golf ball if you leave it off the green. But if you are such a golf fanatic that merely the thought of even stepping away from the game long enough to drop a deuce is too long away from your putter or golf clubs, this was for you. It is... If there was ever going to be a definition of unnecessary, this would be the item to think that not only is this requiring that you're sitting on the toilet practicing your putting in a position that I would expect, unless you've got a very weird posture, you will never assume on the golf course. You're generally not going to be putting from a sitting position. But it takes a little bit of effort to go round this whole thing up and put it in place and snug it against the side of the toilet and put the hole in place and get the ball and get the putter. don't most people kind of move towards the toilet when nature is calling and you want to do your business, like, then? You don't really necessarily plan for, I don't know, let's move along. Very famous one. Everyone's seen this one, the shake weight. Did you ever buy a shake weight? Anyone ever buy a shake weight out there? Yeah, we'll leave that one alone, especially the commercials that involve women using the shake weight. None of them are very good. Here's one that was one of the biggest things ever from Vince. Now, Vince ended up, as I recall, having some legal problems, but Vince, once upon a time, he came up with the slap chop. Remember the slap chop? The slap chop. When you think about the slap chop, which was a device for the four people listening who don't know, it was kind of a, it was a device that you put it on top of vegetables and you pushed down on a thing and it sliced them all up because blades would come down inside this contraption. Unquestionably, it probably chopped up your vegetables faster than you could do it single-handedly. That's no question. But to clean this thing would have taken half an hour. What you would have been so much better just to take a knife and cut it and then wipe the knife off and give it a wash. But slap chop, he did very well with that one. All right, this next one. Big seller. I kind of get who might have used this one if you were immobilized for some reason or if you were on the larger side and had difficulty reaching, I could maybe see it. But the comfort wipe, the long reach comfort wipe, looks almost like, well, it's almost like a tennis racket minus the head. And where the head would have been is a round thing where you put your toilet paper around it so you can reach behind and get in there and do your cleaning. Who's ordering one of these? I mean, okay, as I said, I understand maybe there's people if you have some sort of physical ailment that would not permit you, but would you even want to, would you not find something else? Do you want anyone delivering that to your house or someone at the long reach comfort wipe office even putting your name into their computer or on a postage stamp? They're using one. I don't know how that became a thing. Speaking back to the idea of the golf, the porta pot putty or whatever it's called, the slumber sleeve. All right, if the golf thing at your toilet was the absolute height of unnecessary ridiculousness, the slumber sleeve is probably second. This was a padded band that you slid up. Now imagine for a second, if you're a soccer fan, you know the captain of the soccer team wears an armband. Well, imagine the armband, but instead of that kind of armband, it's made like one of those, you know, one of those foam beer bottle holders that keeps your beer cold. All right, now cut the bottom out of that. So it's just a band, just a loop, and slide that up onto your arm, onto your bicep area. So if you want to lean down on your desk and rest your head on your arm, you have kind of a pillow type thing. Was your arm not sufficient? Was your arm that uncomfortable? Is your arm not soft enough that if you rest your head on your arm while you lay your head on your desk, that it's so uncomfortable? I mean, maybe if you are a world champion bodybuilder, I suppose, and have massive muscles that are hard as a rock, it would be uncomfortable, But even if you were one of those people, I assure you, this thing is not going to fit around your muscles. This is for the average person with skinny arms that, I don't know who would have bought this, but again, it's on the list. They sold a lot of them. They sold a lot of them. All right, this next one, I don't know that anyone would have bought this one. I don't remember seeing this one ever on infomercial land. I didn't watch a lot of infomercials, even though I was up late, but I've seen some of these. The Hawaii chair. Now, what is the Hawaii chair? Well, the Hawaii chair, it looks like kind of like an upright dentist chair. It's got a round base and a back with two arms. The round base is plugged into the wall. It's got a motor on it. And it's called the Hawaii chair because it simulates the hula motion for you at high speed. So while you're sitting at your desk trying to do your work, your body is being forced to do the hula hoop motion, theoretically, because it's going to tone the muscles of your abdomen. I always was of the opinion that for muscles to be toned, you had to do the work to make them flex. But I guess this suggested otherwise. Just sit in this thing and wiggle like you're never wiggled before, and you will be a lithe, muscled, abdominally strong person in no time. So there. Here's one that, again, doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense, but did very well. The Eggstractor. The Eggstractor. You would take hard-boiled eggs. This was a device that looks like, best description would be, if you ever go to hospital and someone is on a ventilator, remember, if you can picture it, there's like a glass container and inside is a fan. It looks like the piping that would go out of your furnace or something, and it goes up and down. Well, this looks like that. You would put a hard-boiled egg in it and press on it, and allegedly it would peel your hard-boiled egg for you. Is peeling a hard-boiled egg really that much of a challenge that we need a device that then takes a long time to clean? Is peeling a hard-boiled egg a hardship that in our society that we cannot tolerate having to do? Seems to be. That one did very well. Let's move along here. All right, here's one that just sold thousands and thousands. For reasons that no one will ever be able to explain ever. It was a piggy bank that was in the shape of someone mooning you. Just the bottom with the pants drooped down. And where you put your coins for the piggy bank is, there's a little slot right there. And every time you drop a coin into this little piggy bank, it makes farting noises. That's what we need. That is go right to the first garage sale pile. The next one, this to me is the absolute epitome of infomercial brilliance. Sold so many of these. I never tried this. I should have. I would fit into the category that could use this. I would be a possibility. I would be a possible customer for this. I have never tried this. I have been tempted to try this just to see how ridiculous this would go, but I haven't. Spray on hair. Anyone ever, come on now, out there, have you ever bought spray on hair? There is a part of me that is so incredibly tempted to buy a can of spray on hair and then go out in public just to see the looks on people's faces. Because I find it highly, highly unlikely. I find it very hard to believe that you could take an aerosol can directed at my shining scalp, and when I walk out the door, people are going to not think, oh, he just spray painted his head, rather than, what a lush head of hair that man has. All I can picture, it's another infomercial, but it's not on this list. You know that guy who does the waterproof stuff? What's it called? I don't even know. The seal stuff where he does the test where he sprays a Flex Seal. Yeah, he sprays the bottom of a boat and he's out in the water and it's holding watertight and everything else. All I can picture is someone taking Flex Seal and spraying their head. And suddenly you look like you're a G.I. Joe or something, that you've had sprayed on hair, that it's a flat, glossy look. I mean, I think it would be kind of hilarious. I think it would be kind of hilarious. In fact, the more I talk about it, the more I'm tempted to just buy a spray-on hair just for the ability to go out one day and see what the reaction would be. Snuggies. We don't even need to go into Snuggies. Everybody knows what the Snuggie is. That one was unbelievably popular. Two more. Two more. One for the men, one for the women, starting with the women. I won't ask any women out there to raise their hand if they ever bought a Kush, which sounds far worse than it really is. The Kush, it seems, and I was unfamiliar with this product until right now. The Kush is a device. It's a cylindrical device. Again, it's not as bad as it sounds. Don't jump to conclusions. It is a cylindrical device that, I guess, for women who are more amply endowed in the chestular region, while you sleep on your side, you are supposed to put this thing between your breasts to rest them more comfortably. Clearly, I have no experience in sleeping with that issue, but no one ever told me that sleeping on your side was going to be needing a device. Maybe, you know, all along, all of us guys have just not understood what's going on, and we all should have been buying devices for people. But someone can tell me if I've just missed something here, but that seems a little unnecessary. And my number one favorite, though, number one, and this one sold tens of thousands, apparently, the Euro Club is a golf club. It's a golf club that goes into your golf bag, like all your other clubs you would put it in there. But it comes with an attached waist cover. Like if you were working in a store somewhere and you're just like in a Home Depot, you know, where they'll put they'll tie the thing around their waist, the little thing. Anyway, and then you put the handle of the golf club, which is actually a hollowed out thing, up to you. And wherever you are on the golf course, if you've had one too many beers, you can just, well, you can use your Euro club and you can drain. Are we so lazy that we couldn't make it to a bathroom? We have to stand in the middle of the fairway to have a piddle? Really? There are more, but alas, we are out of time.
Want to hear more? Download the podcast on iTunes or Google Play and listen to The Scott Radley Show.
Weeknights from 6 to 8
on 900 CHML.
I'm not just a pawn in this game.
Three nights a week on Global.
They're putting targets on their back. Massive.
Drama.
I guess you could say I'm in a showman.
They're just so in love and so annoying. Enough.
Betrayal.
The guy just put up his best friend now.
And plot twists.
What is happening right now?
You'll never see coming.
If you're coming for me,
this is perfect.
I'm coming for you then.
It'll be a battle.
Like, it'll be war.
Big Brother Canada. All new Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Sundays on Global. Stream on Stack TV.